Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
And just be all go down, and just be all go round, and just be switch from side to side.
From newsounds.org, it's time for another of our live in-studio performances in the Soundcheck podcast series, streaming live on Facebook and YouTube. I'm John Schaefer. Amanda Palmer has always known how to do drama. But on her new album, she's mining the drama of a single life, her own. There Will Be No Intermission is the name of the record, and it is a sprawling, ambitious, deeply personal, hugely empathetic album full of songs about life and loss, abortion and childbirth, love and internet trolling. Abortion is actually the topic of the first song that Amanda's going to play for us here in the studio today. With Voicemail for Jill, here is Amanda Palmer.
Jill, it's Amanda just waving from London. I know that you're going tomorrow, the hardest decision. And I've been on the side of the phone for a month, and I know you're in hell, and you know that I know what you're feeling. Life's such a bitch, isn't it? When you have a baby, they throw you party, and then when you die, they get together for a cry. But no one's gonna celebrate you, no one's gonna bring you cake, and no one's gonna shower you with flowers. The doctor won't congratulate you. No one on that pavement's gonna shout at you that your heart also matters. I'm not sure that you'll get this in time. I don't know if you're checking your voicemail at all, but in case it's the morning and you're off of the Green Line and walking through Copley, I want you to stop for a second. I want you to listen. You don't need to offer the right explanation. You don't need to beg for redemption or ask for forgiveness. You don't need a courtroom inside of your head where you're acting as judge and accused and defendant and witness. It's a strange grief, but it's grief. Look at all the women in the street. You know the statistics, Jill. Even though they may not help, isn't it amazing how we can never tell who is in an identical hell. Bring some friends if you want us to come. We can bring you cake and we can bring you flowers. We can bring you wine and we can talk for hours. Ukulele by request. We'll throw you the best abortion shower.
That is Amanda Palmer with Voicemail for Jill, live here in our studio. From her album, the brand new record called There Will Be No Intermission, which comes out on March 8th. Amanda, it's great to have you back with us. Thank you for joining us.
It's so nice of you to have me.
So, on an album that almost seems like a bunch of diary entries, was this a genuine voicemail that you left for someone? Or did it start that way?
Well, I would say, you know, it's more of a mosaic of a lot of conversations that I've been on both sides of in the course of my life. I talk a lot about this in the stage show and in the book that comes along with the record, but I had an abortion when I was 17. I was in high school. And even though I was from a nice little liberal town in Massachusetts, it's not the sort of thing anyone would talk about.
Right.
So I went with my mom and my boyfriend. But then I had two abortions in my 30s as a grown-up, and they were really different experiences. I had them both for very different reasons. And given what's happening politically, I just don't feel like I can't talk about this now.
Well, and where were you when you wrote this song? I mean, I suppose I could ask that metaphorically, but I mean it literally.
There's actually a pretty great story behind the writing of the song. So I had been trying to write about this topic pretty much my entire adult life. And anyone who knows my work with the Dresden Dolls knows that, like, there was a song called Mandy Goes to Med School, which is on the Dresden Dolls' second record. And it's like a jazzy, dripping with irony song about back alley abortion. And then there's a song called Oasis that was on my first solo record that's also a really black humor, dark song about date rape and abortion. But I have found it really hard to write about abortion sincerely and without humor, because I was like, how do you do that? Like, how do you find who is speaking without being too sentimental or too self-pitying or too political or too this, too, like, it's just a really hard topic to crack as a songwriter. And I just kept going back to the table and the piano again and again, year after year, and finding it really impossible. And then I wound up being last spring in Dublin when the repeal vote happened. And I hadn't even really been following things that closely in Ireland. I knew that abortion was illegal there, but I didn't know how bad the situation was for women. Mm-hmm. I didn't know the drama that women had to go through to travel to the UK to get abortions. I didn't know that abortion was punishable by jail. I didn't know that women were dying.
Right. Well, it was one particular death that really kind of spurred that whole
referendum movement. I happened to be there for the Dublin International Literary Festival. Totally coincidentally, I landed in the airport the day of the vote. I landed on a plane with all of these Irish women who were flying from all over to just cast this one vote. There were Irish women coming from Australia and from Asia and from America. And it was overwhelming being there. And then watching the vote happen and being in a hotel in downtown Dublin and literally seeing women openly weeping and dancing in the streets. And, you know, I was lucky. I was friends with all these feminists. They were dragging me to pubs and celebrations, and everyone was like, it's feminist Christmas. But there was a real dark thread going through at the same time as I was looking at the situation, even that day, even that week in America, as abortion clinics were just closing their doors, slowly being shuttered, slowly being made impossible to get to, you know, just watching that all collapse. And I was like, really? Like, Ireland is beating us on the march of progress. And I got home about a week later, and I knew what that voice had to be. It was a solidarity song. It was one woman speaking to another, which in its own way was kind of, you know, threaded together by all of the things that have been happening with the Me Too movement, because the truth is infectious. And women telling their stories shamelessly and openly is starting to have a wildfire effect.
Well, and this gets to one of the interesting things about the record, There Will Be No Intermission, is, I mean, it really is drawn from a lot of chapter and verse of your life. I mean, you talk about abortions and also, you know, being a mother and all the uncertainty that goes with that. And somehow in all of these highly detailed personal stories, we get a sense of the broader kind of environment in which they're happening, you know, where without even having to really mention it, things like climate change and, you know, the political divisiveness of our country are kind of looming in the background of all of these songs.
Yeah. And I mean, you can call it dramatic, but hey, look around.
Yeah. We live in dramatic times, yeah.
I mean, we always have,
yes. Right?
But that's also life. And, you know, as a woman who has gotten used to being called dramatic for the entirety of my career, and it's really like, if you want to stick the knife in, you know, just go ahead and call me dramatic. But also, you know, the truth is often dramatic.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know a human being who hasn't had to walk through extreme suffering and grief and loss. And you can call those things dramatic, or you could just call them life.
Mm-hmm. Well, and of course, the great, irony is the wrong word, but, you know, the way the universe works is the same thing that is dramatic is often very simple. I mean,
everybody dies.
Right. And it may be hard to write a song about abortion, but why wouldn't it be? It's so hard to talk about abortion.
Yeah, well, and that's why.
And
I mean,
becomes,
anything that's hard to talk about
yeah.
is hard to write about. You know, as a constantly evolving songwriter, those things that are impossible to figure out, those are the things I want to write about.
Yeah. Now, as a constantly evolving songwriter, how did you approach this project? Did you know going in that this is what you were going to do?
No, I really didn't. And in fact, there is a real irony. The real irony is that about 4 years ago, when I was gearing up to start my Patreon, which is my subscription service, which is more or less, you know, endless crowdfunding mm-hmm. from 15,000 audience members, I thought I was done with the idea of making records. I thought that I was just going to basically be in like a one-woman NPR, constant live stream of content and songs and thoughts and webcasts. And while that did work, and it's been really fantastic, and like having that much support, just like unflagging, faithful, whatever you've got, Amanda, bring it on support mm-hmm. from 15,000 people is pretty mind-bending. But I got to the point where I realized that not only were these songs really of a piece, because I've written a lot of other material over the last 7 years that hasn't come near this record.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be saved for a later date. It'll just live on the internet. It'll be turned into Dresden Dolls material someday, whatever. But these songs in particular threaded together so obviously into a record. And also, to be truthful, the media still works the way the media has always worked, putting out an album and coming in and doing radio shows and you know, giving the New York Times an excuse to write about me if they ever do. Whatever. Galvanizing and putting everything in one package. Really, the world still works that way.
Yeah.
You know, I couldn't expect the media or the world at large to pay attention to me every 2 weeks, every time I dropped a demo or had something to say. That's exhausting. And I actually realized hypocritically, you know, I was really only paying attention to my favorite artists when they were dropping albums. I wasn't, you know, I'm busy. We're all busy. And
right,
there's a lot of stuff
right.
competing for our attention. So a lot of things sort of synchronized around the same time. And I just realized this is a record. It's time to put it all together and also create, you know, a flow and a sound and the artwork and make it into its own world. And I've got to say, that was also really therapeutic, because with songs like this, to wrap a bow on it
yeah.
and put it out into the world, it's deeply cathartic.
So it is a record, but it is also more than a record. I mean, you alluded to this before. There's also a book full of lyrics, but also lots of backstories to the various songs, photographs, many of them taken upstate New York.
Yeah, it was actually the photographs that led the charge to make a book, because I met this incredible photo art duo called Khan and Selesnik. They work in upstate New York. And they do these beautiful, like highly crafted, almost Victorian-looking photographs mm-hmm. that are, you know, in one sense, they look very formal, but they're also really, like, deeply meaningful. And I teamed up with them thinking that we would just take half a dozen photographs. But we got so much good stuff, and we kept shooting, and we kept working because we loved working together. And also, life kept happening. I had a miscarriage, you know, in between two of the shoots, and we just kept finding different metaphors and different meaning. And at the end of the day, we had 70 photographs.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, these aren't going to fit in a CD booklet.
No.
And they're too beautiful to just toss up on the internet. We need to make a book.
Yeah.
And also, that'll give me a great opportunity to give some context to the songs, which I always love doing.
So when you tour, the show will be, I guess, in a sense, sort of like the book, right? Where you're giving narration between songs.
Yeah, it's a storytelling tour. Yeah. And I actually go places on the tour in the stage show that I don't go in the book.
Mm.
Because I actually wrote the book really quickly. And there's a lot of footnotes in the book saying, like, I'll have to get back to this. It needs too much space for me to just jot down some lighthearted thoughts about miscarriage and abortion.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a real book that I'll write later where I can really do the story's complete justice. But the stage show it's pretty heavy, but it's also really, really funny. It has to be,
yeah.
right? I mean, the same way making the record was like, this was the most hilarious studio experience I had ever had with John Congleton. We were just cracking each other up left and right because we had to survive making a record this heavy.
Well, and even in this record, you know, there are still little streaks of that old dark humor.
There's definitely one joke per song, whether it's hidden or out in the open.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Amanda Palmer's with us here in the studio at our piano, but you also brought in the ukulele.
I did. Should I move?
Yes. Why don't you do that? And the next song that Amanda's going to perform for us is The Thing About Things, which has some interesting ideas in it. So maybe, Amanda, I'll let you play the song first, and then we can talk about what it all means.
What does it all mean? That's the question.
The tour, the solo tour by Amanda Palmer, will include a date here in New York, April 20th at the Beacon Theater. That's a Saturday night. You'll be able to hear and see Amanda Palmer speaking and playing both the piano and the ukulele, as she's doing here in our studio today. Does your dog have fleas? You ready to go?
My dog has all the fleas.
All right. Amanda Palmer with The Thing About Things.
I've loaned a lot of things to a lot of friends, like dresses and records and books, and a lot of time I never see them again. And in a weird way, I think that that works. 'Cause the thing about things is they start to turn evil when you start to forget what they're for. So if you're not sure what you did with my sweater, I'll just have to love you a little bit more. I had a ring. It belonged to my grandfather. He was a mason and gay. And he was distant and bitter for all of my childhood. Wasn't the type to give tokens of affection, so I stole the ring when he died. And then 20 years on, when I lost it in a bar, I thought that's fine, I don't want him in my life. 'Cause the thing about things is that they can start meaning things nobody actually said. And if he couldn't make something mean something for me, I had to make up what it meant. Home, and I think it keeps going, and I've borrowed and loaned lots of things. And 3 nights ago, in the bar where I lost it, the bartender gave me the ring. And I lay in bed with my phone in my hand, thinking, what can I fix with which app? And I call my grandfather and he doesn't answer, and I have to make peace with that fact. 'Cause the thing about things is that they can start meaning things nobody actually said. And if you're not allowed to love people alive, then you learn how to love people dead. The thing about things is that they can start meaning things nobody actually said. And if you're not allowed to love people alive, then you learn how to love people dead.
Amanda Palmer and The Thing About Things, a song from her brand new record, which is entitled There Will Be No Intermission. She'll be touring around solo, playing piano and ukulele, and coming back to New York April 20th, Beacon Theater. So the thing about that song for me, Amanda, is the line goes by, it's just half a line, it goes by really fast. I had to make up what it meant.
Oh my God.
Seems to, I mean, if that's not a description of what art is, I don't know what is.
Well, if it's not a description of how complicated symbols are and the meaning that we find ourselves having to give things, especially, you know, when it comes to our parents and our families and desperately needing to find meaning, mm-hmm. where sometimes there's none to be found, but we have to have it. You know, that's a true story, all of it, including the bar, including the ring, all of it.
And still clearly one that you feel.
Well, I also have a cold. I have a cold. If you couldn't tell in the, like, the caterwauling part of that song is usually a little less caterwauling. I mean, we get extra points for emotion today. Thanks, cold. But yeah, I mean, this gets really meta, right? Because not only is that a thing, and we all know that thing because we've all done it and we've assigned meaning to objects and sometimes without the permission of who and whatever, but also to be able to write a song like that, to actually really like pinpoint what is that emotion. I feel it. I have it. We don't have a word for it. The Germans probably have a word for it. You know, Vergangenheits Bedeutungsschlagen. Like, of course they have a word for assigning false meanings to objects of the past. They're Germans. Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that is so beautiful about art, right? That's why we do it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we can have all of the documentaries and nonfiction and New York Times think pieces in the world, but art gets into the nooks and crannies of the human experience. Other stuff just doesn't.
So one of the things that, you know, a lot of my favorite songs are favorite songs because I have to make up what they mean, you know?
The fun part.
Yeah.
I mean, and the more abstract the art, the better, right? Like Jackson Pollock.
But then
is it about his grandfather? We don't know.
Right. But then there's the other side where art can be really descriptive and, you know, it is clear what it is about. These songs seem to be very clear what they're about.
Yeah.
And yet somehow I felt a way in where I could...
Well, that's such a great topic, right? And I've really thought about that a lot with this record, because this is a direct record. It's like a folk record, basically. I mean, folk, like when I think of songs that are direct, I think of, you know, I had a lot of influences growing up, but folk and punk, mm-hmm. a lot of those songs weren't open to interpretation. They were about things, and they were about important things. And while that was a big part of my lineage, I was also really into The Cure and Depeche Mode and Robin Hitchcock. And, you know, you just didn't know what those songs were about. And it's kind of what made them wonderful and beautiful. My husband, Neil Gaiman, who's a writer, mm-hmm. we have a great term for this when it comes to artistic costuming and like levels of opaqueness in poetry. We call it the blender. And all experiences are real, right? You've got right, the truth. Right. You've got the things that happen. You've got your ideas. And then you can take these experiences and you can put them in a blender, and you can either put the blender setting on one, folk music. You still, like, you open it up and you still can see the tomatoes and potatoes. Or blender setting 10, science fiction. Like, what is it really? Is it a finger? Is it a tomato? We don't
right.
know.
So Neil could take real Norse mythology and real live America and put that blender on.
Yeah.
But somehow, you know.
Also apples and oranges, right? Because both kinds of art are completely necessary.
Yeah.
Even though this is a really direct record, it doesn't mean that for the rest of my life, I'm just going to write really on-the-nose memoir, autobiographical folk songs. I just needed to do this for the last 7 years, mostly because of what I was going through in my life. I needed these songs more than anybody else did. Hmm. I needed to write them this way.
Well, now you mentioned, you know, Patreon and your 15,000 patrons who expect material from you. The thing about things is that thingness has changed in the digital age. You know, things can now appear on your phone in an email. And
yeah.
So do your followers, your fans, do they expect physical things, or is it, you know?
No, the beautiful thing about Patreon, which I'll explain very quickly because it hasn't totally come into household word territory the way Kickstarter has.
Right.
Patreon is basically... I mean, I said it before, the easiest, analog is NPR. These 15,000 people who are supporting me are just giving me about $3 a month. Mm-hmm. And what's actually quite beautiful is they don't expect anything. They've basically just given me free rein to use that or not use that money as I see fit to make whatever I want. Mm-hmm. And that could be demoing songs, making high budget music videos, doing podcasts with interesting people, doing webcasts, creating animations based on old voice memos that I found. Like, sky's the limit. I've done it all. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I'm coming up on 100 pieces of content that I've put out to these guys. But the beautiful thing about it is that there's no expectation. I don't put out art on the first of every month. Mm-hmm. I put it out when I make it, and then I charge them. And they're always very happy to receive it. And they're a really great, empathetic, highly intelligent group of people. And that's sort of a silver lining of, you know, going into the sort of crowdfunding ghetto that I didn't expect. It's like, especially with the internet becoming so difficult to hang out on because there's so much negativity and there's so much yelling and there's so much crap, I all of a sudden have a place where I can just put my material and 15,000 intelligent people will discuss it. And I hadn't realized how much I had missed that until I got it back. And it reminds me a little bit of the internet of 2005 and 6, like before social media as we know it kind of crushed the blogs and crushed the more intelligent, more compassionate internet, you know, where people would discuss things at length
right.
and wouldn't just scream and yell.
So this idea of things, physical versus digital, I mean, here you have a very physical project suddenly, you know, yeah. with a record and a book and photos.
And I mean, I've been dealing with this since I got free of my major label in 2009, which is keeping one foot on the internet and one foot in the real world. Because as fun as it is to like hang out in my cave with all of my ardent supporters, I do need to occasionally like gather up my wares and brave the busy marketplace of life to try and hawk my songs. And this is one of those moments. I haven't put out a big record since 2012.
Right.
And it's also kind of scary for me to go back into the arena of critics and, you know, people who have just like made it their job to hate me since 2004. They're all going to have something to say about this record. And I'm like, oh, I don't want a deal. But I'm really shored up because, you know, chart success doesn't matter to a person like me. A bad review doesn't matter to a person like me. I know who I am so profoundly at this point. I stand by my work so steadily, and I don't really need the approval and the signal boosting of the mainstream press to get where I need to go. I've created it off-grid.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
And was there a light bulb moment for you when you realized that this was the path that you were going to go down, or was it just kind of a one thing led to another and here you are?
I almost have Roadrunner Records to thank for it. Because they were, as far as a major label experience goes, it was like a cartoon bad experience. It was literally a cartoon of like me sitting at a giant boardroom table with 12 men, all of them scratching their heads and saying, but why on earth would you do that? And I mean, I ran screaming from that record deal with a way deeper understanding of what drove the music industry and the very frightening commercial and capitalist agenda behind even some of the kindest entities still have to make their fourth quarter, still have to, you know, really cut artists off at the knees when they're trying to run towards a, you know, a really, really strange artistic decision. And I just didn't want to do it. I didn't want to have to learn how to play that game and speak that language. And I was also really lucky because timing-wise, right at that time that I left the label, I knew I had enough reach and power on the internet that I could build my own car and drive away. Mm. And I was like, I looked around at my fan base. I took the temperature. I was like, will you guys come with me? They all raised their hands and said, yes. And I said, okay, like, I've built this car, everybody in, we're out of here. And it hasn't been the easiest, you know? And a lot of people in the music industry still really don't like that I don't play by the rules.
Yeah.
But I also never could have anticipated back then the profound impact that that kind of unconditional trust from a tribe of people, the impact that that would have on my songwriting. That I didn't know. I didn't realize that being a part of a community so tight and empathetic would really fuel my ability to be more liberated and more free as a songwriter than I'd ever imagined possible.
Well, actually, the song you're about to do, Drowning in the Sound, isn't that a pretty good example of exactly what you just talked about?
Yeah, this song actually was like a historic song in the story of my Patreon because so to be totally honest, and it is important for me to be totally honest, if I want to be transparent about art and money and business and how the Patreon works, if I don't put something out in a given month, I don't get paid. Luckily, I'm really prolific and I write things all the time and I've got lots of material on the back shelf that I can drag out and clean off and put out. This particular month, this was August of 2 years ago, I didn't have anything and I was freaking out because I run a pretty, you know, we
you
run
You didn't
a
have a solstice song? I mean, a sun, well, that was the eclipse, right?
So,
it was the solar eclipse.
So here's what happened. It was the end of August. I had two videos in production that were both late. And I just went to my blog, to my Patreon blog, and I said, you guys, I've wanted to do this since I started the Patreon. Will you get on board with this? I know myself as a songwriter really well, and I know myself well enough to know that I work really well under pressure, and I don't have anything to put out. And I'm at home, I'm in upstate New York. What if I just book a studio, go in tomorrow, write a song from scratch, and put it out the next day? And everyone was like, yes! I was like, all right, here we go. I'm going for broke. And this song is going to have to be good or this will be really awkward. And I also posted a blog in the same blog. I said, you guys are going to help me do this. Leave me a comment. Take a second and tell me what is going on with you. Could be anything. Could be relationship stuff. It could be your life. It could be this. It could be that. And having not anticipated the amount of comments I would get back, I got like 1,500 comments. Some of them were like 10 paragraphs long. So most of the next day was spent just reading, you know, comments that were the size of a novel. And Hurricane Harvey had just happened. I had several patrons who were freaked out. They'd had to leave their homes. They didn't know if they were ever going to be reunited with their belongings, their houses, their reality. The eclipse had just happened. I had taken my child down to Tennessee to where he was born so that we could see the full eclipse. And that was a really profound experience. It was still resonating. And then that morning, I posted what I thought was like a flippant, silly comment to Facebook about Taylor Swift's new video for Look What You Made Me Do. And I was like, you go, Taylor. You're finally embracing your dark goth side. We support you. We all got to do that as teenagers. You were too busy being a like wholesome country star while we were all dressing in black and slicing our wrists and smoking clove cigarettes. It wasn't even really meant ironically. I was like, it's kind of nice to see the angry side of Taylor Swift. P.S. You might want to rethink your endorsement deal with UPS. UPS trucks are brown. Brown's not goth. You might want to think about another endorsement deal with something black like coal. I came back to my computer 15 minutes later, and the post had blown up, and the top comment was, Amanda Palmer is an unapologetic racist. And in the A, B, C, D of the internet, the argument basically went, Taylor Swift is a racist because she's used black women as props in her videos. If Amanda is saying anything about Taylor Swift right now that is not about that, she is clearly a racist.
Right.
And I was like, there's the internet for you.
Yep.
Good morning. But, you know, and this was like as I was throwing on my backpack and getting ready to walk into the studio, and it all came together in one song.
In this song called Drowning in the Sound. It's Amanda Palmer. It's from her new record out on March 8th called There Will Be No Intermission, but here's a live performance in our studio.
Worship the sun, you're aching for change. But you keep starving your heart, and you used to have sisters, you don't anymore. You worship the sun, but you keep feeding the dark. And I'm out in the yard with my son and my daughter. Sky is all black, and I think we should start running, running from the water. And everybody's yelling, they're yelling that they're coming, but I don't see a single soul. They're all so busy yelling, not one of them is hearing the hissing from the bottom of the boat. I got some feelings up my sleeve. I got a needle in my heart. I got a compass in my arm. It's gonna tell us where we are. South by southwest, 2 miles downtown. I can't get up. I can look down if you can hear. If you're around, I'm over here. I'm over here. I'm watching everyone. I worship the sun, but the moon's in the way. So get your armaments out. She's always looking for trouble. She's gonna get what's been coming to her. She's switching the tides and we can't have that shit around. The television, they're blaring out a warning that our natural state is drowning, that our natural state is burning. And you're trying to help, and you're clicking for change, and you're calling it out, and you're adding your name, and you're marching for peace, but you're lynching the bitch that got up in your face. I wasn't gonna take you seriously. And the prison's overcrowded, and the inmates know it's flooded, and the body politic is getting sicker by the minute, and the media's not fake, it's just very inconvenient.
I think I might have broke your piano, but we'll keep going. It's really on topic. Actually gonna fix this. I think I can fix it. There we go. I fixed it. Man, Piano Slayer in action. Do you ever feel like this should be officially the end, and that you should be the one to do the ending, but you can't? Do you ever feel like everyone is slowly letting go? Do you ever feel that? That incredibly alone, and they're saying not to panic, and it's like a broken record, as if anybody knows what that is. And they're saying that we'll manage, it's the hardest one on record, and they're saying that that's just the way it is. And now I can taste it coming, I can taste it with my tongue, and my children are so heavy, but I pick them up and run. And I know I'll have to swim soon when the water gets too high. I keep holding them above me, I keep holding them and crying. South by southwest, 2 miles from town. I can't get out, I can't look down. If you can hear, if you're around, I'm over here, I'm over here, I'm watching. Everyone I love, everyone I love, everyone I drowning in the sound. You worship the sun and you're aching for change, but you keep starving your heart, and you used to have sisters, you don't anymore. You worship the sun, but you keep feeding the dark. Sorry for breaking your piano.
A little bit of everything there.
Your poor F. Yeah, that was really fun. I had to spend the second half of the song avoiding that F.
But yeah, nicely done. And singing into the piano strings to get the resonance, a little elbow smash.
Yes, this is the sea of climate change. Yeah, and this is actually, no, this is the void into which we shout when we talk, when we comment on Facebook. This is just a pile of Facebook comments.
How Buddhist.
It's everything.
Shouting into the void. Amanda Palmer, live in our studio. The album is called There Will Be No Intermission. Basically, in what? In life, you know, you're
yeah,
in it.
It's relentless, yeah. Man, but it's also beautiful,
yeah.
You know?
Amanda, congratulations. It's a terrific project, and the book and the photos and the music, of course. Thank you for coming in and playing for us today.
Thank you so much for allowing me to do this to your piano and your ears.
Amanda Palmer on this edition of the Soundcheck Podcast. That's all for this Soundcheck podcast. Hear other Soundcheck podcasts and see other videos online at newsounds.org. Our technical director is Irene Trudell. Our associate producer is Karen Havlick. Our video producer is Justin Sergi. I'm John Schaefer. Thanks for being with us.